love this season, Easter season. You know, Jesus turned his face toward Jerusalem, and I feel like I'm going right there with him. And I appreciate Tim sharing what he shared at communion, because we'll be going through that together. Next week, all five of us on staff will each do a devotional online for each day of the week. And I think mine is for Thursday, so that's the one he talked about a lot. They're great. It's amazing how much of the Gospels occurred that last week between Palm Sunday and the crucifixion and resurrection. It's just amazing encounters and things that Jesus did. So I'm looking forward to that. I do every year. We who are believers find that we live in the same world as unbelievers. We see the same circumstances, experience the same kinds of things that they experience. Most believers I know never claim to have seen visions. We don't hear voices. We don't experience the kind of miracles that could prove in some scientific, demonstrable way that God exists. Like unbelievers, we're troubled by the same evil and pain in the world, by the same suffering in our own lives. And like unbelievers, we often find ourselves disappointed in Christians. Like unbelievers, we're disappointed by the lack of growth and progress in our own lives. And yet, we choose to believe in and bet our entire existence on a God we cannot see, cannot touch, cannot hear, and cannot prove. Unbelievers choose to bet their entire existence on the notion that such a God does not exist. That's what's at stake. Our whole lives, the purpose and the point of our lives. In sermon 2 weeks ago, we talked about part of the case for faith. We said that choosing to believe in God is the sanest, most rational, most joyous choice that a human being can make. But this morning, I want to look at a couple of areas that are troubling to people who would like to have faith, who would like to believe but get hung up on some really sticky questions. So we'll consider three of those questions this morning. The first is this: if believing in God is important to him, why doesn't God make himself more obvious? Why doesn't he just part the clouds and write his name in the sky? Why doesn't he give us more compelling proof and evidence? So we're calling the sermon "The Hidden Face of God." Why? Why is God's face hidden? One of the most famous atheists in the last century was Bertrand Russell. When he was 90 years old, he had a famous encounter with a woman at a party. The woman said to him, "Mr. Russell, you're not only the world's most famous atheist, you're also maybe the world's oldest atheist. You will die soon. What will you do if, after you die, it turns out that God exists? What will you do? What will you do if you come face to face with this God that you've defied your whole life long?" Bertrand Russell responded to her that he would point his finger at God and he would say, "You, sir, gave us insufficient evidence." And I kind of get what he's saying. There have been times in my life when I've kind of wanted some sufficient evidence for belief. However, God seems to present himself to us in such a way that people who want to dismiss God will be able to dismiss him. He seemed to leave space for that. People who do not want to believe there is a God will find a way not to believe in him. But people who want to believe that there is God will find a lot of reasons to believe. Another atheist philosopher named Norwood Russell Hansen said, "I'm not a stubborn guy. I've become a theist, a believer, under some conditions. I'm open-minded." And he lays out the conditions under which he would believe. He says, suppose next Tuesday, just after breakfast, all of us in this one world are knocked to our knees by a percussive and ear-shattering thunderclap. The sky is ablaze with an eerie silvery light, and just then, as all the people in this world look up, the heavens open, the clouds part, revealing an unbelievably radiant and immense Zeus-like figure towering over the features of his Michelangeloid face. Then he points down at me and explains for every man, woman, and child to hear, "I've had quite enough of your too clever logic chopping and word watching in matters of theology, be ashamed. Norwood, Russell, Hansen, I do most certainly exist. Those are Hansen's conditions for becoming a believer in God. Think about that for a moment. If this were to actually happen, there'd be a big shock. It would be news. No one would want to talk about anything else for a long time. But as time passed, as days became months and months became years and years became decades, the memory would fade and people would start to second guess themselves. Maybe we were having, you know, a mass illusion. Maybe it was just a thing that only existed in our mind. Maybe we didn't really see that or hear that, because I don't see evidence for it now. Part of what this gets to, I think, is deep, a deep issue. I think people would just forget and walk away, wander away. God's goal for the human race is not just to get people to be forced to admit that he exists. That's not his goal. Forcing people to admit that God exists does not really solve the core problem of the human race. Even if they admit that God exists, there's still the problem of the human heart. So now we begin to see part of God's problem in dealing with the human race. People can believe in the supernatural, but still be moral or spiritual disasters. James put it like this. He said, you believe there is one God? Good. Even the demons believe that and shudder. Now, do these demons believe that the one God is good and just and fair and loving? Do these demons believe the same things about this God that Jesus believed about his Father? No, they don't at all. For all of us, what goes on in our heart colors our capacity to perceive any other being. None of us can see God exactly as he is. We see him through a filter. And the filter isn't always clear. And simply acknowledging that the supernatural exists, that a God exists, does not solve the problem of the human heart. For people who don't want to believe in God, it'll just make them nurse the bitterness, anger, and darkness all the more deeply and secretly in their hearts. This is part of why the scriptures say, Jeremiah 29, you will seek me and you will find me when you seek me with all your heart. What does it mean, seek God with all your heart? Well, it means that I seek him above everything else. It means that I seek him more than I seek money or status or pleasure or success or fame or security. I want to know God. He promises that if you do that, you will find him. Jesus said in Matthew 7, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. He who seeks finds. And to him who knocks, the door will be open. Of course, God's so good that he also comes to people who search half-heartedly sometimes. He comes to people who aren't looking at all. And if there's any crack, any opening, he'll walk through it. But his promise is, if you search for me with all your heart, devotedly, persistently, sincerely, soberly, you're going to find me. God doesn't force himself on you, but he isn't so hidden that it can't be found if you're looking for him. Second question that troubles folks sometimes is this. If Christianity is true, why aren't Christians better advertisements? Has that ever troubled you? It troubles me all the time. It's an extremely passionate issue for some people. Sam Harris, who wrote Letter to a Christian Nation and The End of Faith, argues that Christianity and religion actually pose the greatest threat to civilization and human survival that exists in our world today. That's been a common theme, I think, especially over the last 25 years and the ongoing threat of terrorist attacks. Those who cite this objection will point to things in history like the Crusades, the Inquisition, the Salem witch trials, and on and on. They talk about how the Bible has been used historically to defend slavery or to defend the subjugation of women or the, quote, divine right of kings. An atheist named Steven Weinberg put it like this in a quote, and this quote really kind of gets under my skin. He says, good people do good things and bad people do bad things, but to get good people to do bad things, that takes religion. And that quote bothers me because there's a lot of truth in it. I think the place to start here is to acknowledge that many horrible things have been done in the name of God, including the name, the name of the God of the Bible. And all of us who are Christians ought to look at these things, these episodes. We ought to look within our own hearts, these errors, openly and honestly and humbly, and not get defensive about it. It's not our place to defend every other believer in Jesus or other believer in God. Some people who have an historical axe to grind may exaggerate or distort this argument, but all of us, I think, should be open to the truth. Peter says, for it is time for judgment to begin with the family of God. That's where it's going to begin. Then I think we also have to ask, were these events, these horrible atrocities, were they committed by obeying the teachings of Jesus? The Jesus who said, love your enemies? The Jesus who said, bless those who persecute you? The Jesus who said, when somebody hits you, turn the other cheek? The Jesus who said on the cross, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Were things like the Crusades or the Inquisition the outcome of his teachings, or were they a contradiction of his teachings? You also, I think, have to ask the question, has the human race done better in societies that seek to eliminate faith altogether? Has that experiment worked better? Because, there have been some civilizations, some societies, some cultures that have sought to eliminate any belief in God. A lot of them in the last century. And then you have to recognize that the greatest bloodbaths in the history of the human race occurred during the 20th century in countries that sought to eliminate God, worship, and faith. Stalin is thought to have been responsible for 20 million deaths. Mikhail Gorbachev put that estimate at closer to 35 million. A recent book by two scholars said that Mao Zedong alone in China was responsible for something like 70 million deaths. Other estimates are much lower than that. 14 million. What a low estimate that is. Hitler in Nazi Germany was responsible for somewhere around 10 million deaths, including about 6 million Jews who died in the Holocaust. Then you look at despots like Pol Pot in Cambodia, an atheist regime where the estimate is that 20% of the population of that entire country was massacred by a leader who said he had no accountability to God. There's a phrase in the Old Testament that refers to someone like that. Does not fear the Lord. No accountability to God. And I think that evil on an international scale, or terrorism, oppression, or so on, exists not because of religious faith or differences. I believe it's possible only because of the evil that can take root in the human heart and grow there and flourish there. As John Lennon suggests, imagine, remove all religion, no worship, no churches, no God, no faith, no belief in an afterlife. Can you honestly believe that that would remove the darkness that exists in human hearts? I don't think so, John. Imagine a society with no religion, no faith, no God. You know what? It's been tried. You really think that means that in that society, nobody's going to covet someone else's house or someone else's spouse? That people with skin tones that are different suddenly are going to become each other's devoted servants? The problem of otherness is suddenly going to be solved? You mean to tell me that if religion is done away with, greedy people will become generous, angry people will become merciful, And bitter people will become grateful? I don't think so. A more common objection than that faith is terribly dangerous and violent is the run-of-mill observation that Christians tend to be hypocrites. My short response to that one is, yeah, we are. I am. I fall short every day of the values that I believe in. But I'll tell you who else are hypocrites? Non-Christians. Again, this is just part of the human condition. Posing, hypocrisy, image management, spin, whatever you want to call it. You can say that you have faith, or you can say that you don't have faith. But part of what Jesus and the prophets taught us is that this is part of the human condition. It's happened ever since the garden. We're all in this boat. The third troubling question is, if there's really an all-loving, all-powerful, all-good, a competent God overseeing the universe, why is there so much evil and suffering and pain? If God is good, why are there so many natural disasters like volcanic eruptions and earthquakes and tsunamis, accidents like car crashes and fires, diseases like heart attacks and cancer and Alzheimer's and diabetes? Steve Weinberg again says, the God of birds and trees would also have to be the God of birth defects and cancer. Dostoevsky, who was a devout believer in God, wrote that the death of a single infant calls into question the existence of God. I think it does. I know some of you have experienced that level of pain. Some Christians respond with bad answers that come from misguided theological theories like Calvinism. It was God's plan. It was God's will that your child got cancer and died. Some can be unfeeling or condescending. Some may tell people that they've not been delivered because they don't have enough faith. We had a lady in our church back in Texas that fought cancer for years, and she was finally near the end, and she was in the hospital under hospice care the last few days, and a group of Christians came and met with her family outside of the room and said, the reason that she has not been cured is because you just don't have enough faith. Let us go in and pray for her, and she'll be healed. What a horrible thing to say to someone whose loved one is passing away. She's dying because you're not faithful enough. It makes me kind of wonder why the apostles all died. Were they not faithful enough? Where's Paul now? Some may tell people that they brought their suffering on themselves because of their sin. There's a judgment. They're being judged. Like, you know, some preachers like Pat Robertson, John Hagee, and Jerry Falwell, statements they made about Hurricane Katrina and other disasters, saying that the reason it happens is because you're also guilty. You're such sinners. God was punishing you. Why is there this kind of pain and suffering and evil in the world? Part of the answer is, I don't know. God didn't explain it all to me. Read the book of Job. Does he explain it all? I do find it interesting that in some religions, evil and suffering don't even constitute the basis for an intellectual problem. In Hinduism, for example, suffering is a result of bad karma left over from a previous life. If you're suffering in this life, you're working off bad choices that you made in a past life. Or in Buddhism, both suffering and joy are understood to be illusory, the result of human desire. And thus the goal of spiritual life is to eliminate desire so as to become immune to suffering and evil and pain. Just don't care about life and anything that happens to you and your loved ones. That's the solution. I've said those approaches, this particular issue, have never been able to make much sense to me. I do believe God made human beings with free will, and free will inevitably includes the capacity to do evil things and sometimes just dumb things. and to bring suffering to others and yourself. And it certainly introduced to our world the fallenness that we all recognize and live with every day. I do believe God looks at earth from an eternal perspective, which is not my perspective, that God understands that one day suffering is going to be redeemed. God sees this in a way that I don't, and it has to make his perspective different from mine. I do believe that the message of the cross, partially part of the message of the cross, is that God has chosen to take the full weight of human suffering and cosmic evil and even what might be called God-forsakenness, as Tim talked about, God-forsakenness on himself. Jesus hung on the cross and said, my God, why have you forsaken me? I do believe that Jesus introduced us to a suffering God, something the world had never even thought possible before. I don't know the full answer, but I do know that those things. I'm also struck by the consequence when I consider the alternative thought that there is no God, there's no story, there's no point. I'm struck not only by what you might call the hiddenness of God, but also by what might be called the silence of atheism or the emptiness of no God. That's not a strange silence. That silence is not a puzzle. It's not a riddle. That silence is a silence that says that's all there is, just silence. No answer, no meaning, no nothing. Richard Dawkins, famous atheist, put it like this: the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. And now, I guess you get to choose what you're going to base your life on. I invite you to consider two alternatives and their consequences. One of them, to paraphrase Bertrand Russell, is you're the product of causes that have no purpose or meaning. Your origin, your growth, your hopes, fears, loves, beliefs are the outcome of accidental collections of atoms. No fire, heroism, or intensity of thought or feeling can preserve your life from beyond the grave. And all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the labor of all the ages are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system. The whole temple of human achievement must inevitably be buried in the debris of the universe in ruins. That's what we're all headed for. Anybody want to vote for that one? Or will you choose this one? This is Dallas Willard, and I think it's a pretty good summary of the message of the Bible about this. Dallas Willard says, you are the uniquely designed creation of a thoroughly good and unspeakably creative God. You are made in his image with a capacity to reason, choose, and love that sets you apart from all other life forms. God's aim in human history is the creation of an all-inclusive community of loving persons, with himself included, as its primary sustainer and most glorious inhabitant. He is even now at work to bring this about. You have been invited at great cost to God himself to be part of this radiant community. You, right there in your life, you will not only survive death, you yourself were made to bear an eternal weight of glory you cannot now even fathom, and you will one day know. You must decide which one to stake your life on. Now, the mere fact that atheism is ultimately depressing, and it is, does not mean that it's false. It's true. If it's true, we might as well own up to it now. But we all have this sense, not just that life is hard, not just that we suffer. We have this sense, not just that things are bad, but that things are not the way they're supposed to be. Children are not supposed to grow up with no one caring about them. Women are not supposed to be abused. Dads are not supposed to die of cancer when they're 40 years old and they still have little children at home. If the universe is a machine, a giant accident, a blind, pitiless indifference, where do we get the idea that there's a way that things are supposed to be? Jesus said we have that eye because there is a way that things are supposed to be. And it's beautiful and glorious beyond imagining. Oh, Hebrew prophets used to talk about it, dream about it, and they had a word for it. That word is shalom. All things the way they're supposed to be. And one day, I am completely confident they will be. Our hunger for it keeps driving us to God. Our running away from God is why it was broken in the first place. But through the proclamation of the good news, the gospel of Jesus Christ, we have been let in on God's previously hidden plan for the restoration of the way things ought to be. I think Paul kind of summarizes it in Romans 8, verses 18 through 25. He says, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. For the creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit, we groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption to sonship, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we were saved. But hope that is seen is no hope at all. Who hopes for what they already have? But if we hope for what we do not yet have, we wait for it patiently. Hope that is seen. A God whose face is apparent, not hidden. That's no hope at all, he says. But if we hope for what we do not yet have, we wait for it patiently. We endure. We believe. We continue to walk that path that leads us to God, to an end point in our life that means something, that matters, that is a solution to all the problems that we know. That's the good news of Jesus.